Good evening. Welcome to this evening's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California and the Northern California Peace Corps Association. I am Will Sparger, member of the club's International Relations Forum, former president of the Northern California Peace Corps Association, and your chair for today. We also welcome our online and radio listeners, and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight, we have three special guests: Lisa Hoffman, Hilary Brasseth, and Veronica Kanilau, who are recently returned Peace Corps volunteers who served in diverse regions around Guinea in West Africa as the Ebola epidemic gained worldwide attention. They will be discussing the lives they shared with their host communities. Their everyday interactions will put a human face on the peoples young and old struggling to fight the Ebola epidemic in a country of limited medical resources. Our moderator for tonight is Frank Price, who is on the board of directors of the Northern California Peace Corps Association and served as a volunteer in the West African nation of Cote d'Ivoire from 1969 to 1972. I'll now turn the program over to Frank.
Thank you, Will, and thank you all for coming. For me, it's a pleasure and honor to be with you and with these three former RPCVs. Let me just give you a brief bio of each one. From my left, that going that direction, is Hilary. Hilary is the founder and executive president of the DARE to Innovate Board of Directors. She was in Guinea, and she's going to fill you in on the details. She worked in waste management, recycling, ecotourism, and entrepreneurship and empowerment in Guinea. Next is Veronica, and Veronica was an education volunteer in Guinea. She taught middle school chemistry in the Fouta Jalon region, and she's now currently teaching a class at UC Berkeley for high school students. And the far end over there is Lisa Hoffman, who made her way from Ohio, got her nursing degree at Loyola University of Chicago, and graduated the BS in nursing, and she also was in public health in Guinea. And she's also transitioning towards a career in international public health. I'm going to start out with the first question to Hilary. Tell us a little bit about your service, the where, when, what you did, and so forth.
Sure. Thanks, Frank. And actually, I did put together some slides, so if we can maybe dim the lights a little bit and have a look up front. Thanks, Norma. So I thought it might be useful to kind of set a little bit of a context for tonight's conversation, as we realize that many of you come from varying backgrounds, and some know exactly what Guinea is, others don't, some know what Peace Corps is, others don't, and same with Ebola. So in order to get us launched on sort of an equal platform, I'd love to start with setting that context and talking about place, Peace Corps, and pandemic. And actually, I love this photo because it's so iconic of Guinea. As you can see, this young gentleman is sporting a Napoleon Dynamite t-shirt and sharing a very ancient-looking photo album. And this is so just the epitome of the irony that just exists constantly, and often it's quite hilarious. So beginning with place, how many of you have ever heard of Guinea? How many of you had heard of Guinea before Ebola? How many of you know where Guinea is? Not bad. I'm assuming we might have quite a few Peace Corps volunteers in the audience. So here's where Guinea is. It's a slight change, slight nuance from the former slide. But it's over there in the corner, the little lighter blue shaded in against West Africa. So it's a teeny country, but it's actually probably about the size of Oregon, from what I recall, when we were told about Guinea. And here's an up-close of West Africa. And when the Ebola hit the news, this was quite prominent, this region. But Ebola did originate in sort of the forest region, if you guys want to point to the forest region, of Guinea, which borders Sierra Leone and Liberia. Guinea is an interesting place. It got its independence from France back in 1958. It was actually the first ever French colony to say, get out. And the French were upset because they saw so many natural resources in Guinea and actually wanted it to be the controlling grounds of all of their West African colonies. So when Guinea said, leave, the French were pretty upset, and they literally up and left within a month, every single one of them. It was communist thereafter until 1984, and then as soon as the communist dictator died, Guinea went through about 4 days of anarchy because everyone thought that the dictator had staged his death, because he would often do that throughout his reign, and just see who might step into power and then assassinate them. So no one had courage to take the lead, and eventually the military just put somebody in the seat, and he ended up leading until 2008, which isn't that long ago. And then he died, and then Guinea became a democracy in 2011. Guinea is ranked 179th out of 187 countries on the Global Human Development Index. It's also ranked 145 out of 175 on Transparency International's Corruption Index, a recipe for fun. It's also been ranked the world's worst economy for the third consecutive year. And it also boasts a 70% youth unemployment rate. Ironically, it's incredibly rich in iron ore, diamonds, gold, uranium, and it holds more than 50% of the world's bauxite reserves. There's an inherent lack of infrastructure. There's very few roads. There's no waste system. And the capital city still cannot provide running water and consistent electricity. While I was there, we nearly experienced an ethnic civil war due to the very first legislative elections happening. The political parties often divide on ethnic lines. And of course, most recent, just when you think you can't get low enough, you get kicked in Ebola. So I did want to just share these because I think it sets a context for how and why the epidemic spread as such. And I think a lot of us might say, who were living there, that we're not altogether too shocked the way that it went. Despite these stats, Guinea is a place of an extreme beauty. This is actually taken in the region where I lived, and I worked a lot in ecotourism. It's a place of connection, one of hard work, one of sacrifice, one of deep passion. They love football. One of faith, Guinea's 98% Muslim. Happy Ramadan to those of you in the audience. One of determination. This was taken during one of my trainings, and literally this car is being used to transport a whole ton of mangoes. One of irony. One of chaos. One of community. One of deeply embedded history. You can notice up on the top, there's these like iconic photos, and this is almost everywhere in Guinea. The homes, people have these photos of like their great-great-great-great-grandfathers. And then, of course, President Alpha Condé. One of rooted tradition. One of profound challenge. One of resilience. This is a water pump. One of great paradox. One of possibility. They're putting on a roof to a hut. Takes a lot of hands. One of hope. And now let's talk a little bit about Peace Corps. Nearly 220,000 volunteers have served to date in 160 countries. The average age of a volunteer is 28, who serves for roughly 27 months. It's about 2 years. And today, there are 6,818 volunteers in 64 countries. And interestingly, the breakdown is largely female, go women, 27% male. And there are three simple goals in the Peace Corps. To help the people of interested countries in meeting their need for trained men and women. To help promote a better understanding of Americans on the part of the people served. And to help promote a better understanding of other peoples on the part of Americans. I'd say we're doing pretty well at goal number three tonight. Peace Corps Guinea. After a rocky transition to democracy in early 2011, Peace Corps reinstated its volunteers. I went to Guinea in November of that year, not too long after the very first democratically elected president took his seat. I went to learn, to grow, to work, to challenge my understandings, and to dissect the essence of what it means to help and to be helped. I didn't go to serve. I went to live. And though our presence is often understated, our impact is powerful. And I want to share with you a quote from President Alpha Conde. He said this to the director of Peace Corps last year. And he said, again, he's president, "I had a Peace Corps volunteer teacher who was the first person I can remember who believed I had a future outside the boundaries of my village. He was an agroforestry volunteer who every night opened up his house to students for homework help." I think this is often what Veronica and Lisa can attest to. This is frequent. "He helped me with my math, my science, my English, and my French. And when it came time for me to take my national exams, I passed. I was one of four people that year who qualified for university. I am certain I would not be president today if not for his support and encouragement, and he is a lifelong friend to this day." But even more important than his impact on my life, which is profound, is the impact of your volunteers on my people. During the course of my six-month campaign for the presidency, I visited over 300 villages in Guinea. I went to villages in the far east of my country where my own campaign staff would not dare to go, and there were Peace Corps volunteers there. I went to villages in the remote north where civil servants refused to be posted, and there were Peace Corps volunteers there. I went to villages in the center of the country, visited by NGOs who come to drop off bags of rice or cement or to do a training, and they do good work. Yet at the end of the day, they get back into their big white SUVs and drive back to the capital. But your volunteers, they stay. By your presence, you tell my people that Americans care about them, that my people are so important to you that you are willing to leave thousands of miles from home to learn our language, to eat our food, even though it makes your belly sick. This is true. Amoebic dysentery is not fun. Work with us on our priorities. Your being there validates my people in a way that giving them money, even building a school, could never accomplish. Your being there validates my people even more than the millions of dollars of foreign assistance your country sends my country every year. My people are proud to teach you their language, their way of life, their culture. They are proud to call you family. You give them a hand up, not a hand out. And that makes all the difference. And again, this is the president of Guinea to Carrie Hassler rattle it. Lastly, the pandemic. In early March of 2014, we received text messages warning us of a strange hemorrhagic fever in Guinea's forest region. Eventually, it was identified as Ebola. We were told not to worry. Life went on pretty normally. I left Guinea in late April of 2014, thinking I might return later that year. And though the disease was quietly and quickly spreading by then, my family hardly knew of it, happy to have me home. And then, one night in late July, Brian Williams Nightly News, which my parents adored before things happened, he started talking about Ebola, and Guinea showed up on the screen, and whereas my mother was largely ignorant to the situation, and I left it so because she would have been far more nervous than she needed to be, they turned to me and were like, "Oh my gosh, you were just there." And I was like, "Yeah, it's been going on for a while." And the reason why is because an American had gotten Ebola, and all of a sudden, everybody was talking about it. Meanwhile, since December of 2013, the disease had waged. And on July 29th, kind of in line with when Brian Williams began talking about the epidemic, Peace Corps volunteers were told that they had 24 hours to pack their bags, to say their goodbyes, and to leave their villages. Not all that dissimilar than when the French up and left in 1958. 11,200 people have died to date from the epidemic. And I guess it makes me question a little bit. Does the value of human life carry different weight in different places? This is a photo of the father of patient zero, Emil, the first boy who contracted the disease in December, and he ended up losing his mother, his grandmother, his wife, his sister as well. And now we're talking about preparing ourselves for the next pandemic. But this one still isn't over. And there's been recent resurgence in some areas of these countries that were not traced necessarily. So what will it take to get to zero? I have the luck to be in contact with one of President Conde's lead Ebola advisors who works for Harvard. And he spent about 9 months advising on the epidemic. And he said that the major challenges are organization and execution. So competent personnel, discipline, community engagement. There's a massive lack of trust and just extreme resistance for lots of reasons. And then also tools. There still has not been a dissemination of rapid diagnostic tests in these areas, and also a lack of integrated and real-time data. But what I think is most important is just being there. So we can...
Okay.
Sorry,
can we get the lights back on, please? Thank you. Okay, Veronica, can you tell us about your experiences in your community? What happened? What did people do?
Just in general?
In general, yes.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for that, Hillary. I was just starting to tear up a little bit with that. So can you all hear me?
No.
Oh, a little bit? So I was in the center of Guinea in the forest region. Oh, sorry, it was more like mountainous. So it was actually pretty cold. A lot of times it was like Bay Area weather. And in my village, I taught chemistry and English to middle school students. And over there, the middle school goes from 7th to 10th grade. And my classes range in size from like 50 to 80. So I had a lot of students in one room, and there would be three students to a desk, stuff like that. And we would have chalkboards and pretty much no other materials. You go inside the room and it's desks and a chalkboard and that's it. So teaching chemistry was kind of a struggle, but the Peace Corps did give us resources so we could do experiments every now and then for the students. And those were always like a joy and amazing because students were so used to just memorizing stuff that their teachers would explain to them in French. And then they would just kind of regurgitate that back on the test. So my village was fairly large. It was probably about like 6,000 people. We would mostly come together on our market days, which were once a week. And that's the one day when you can buy fruits and vegetables, and everybody dresses in their finest, most beautiful clothing, as we saw in some of the pictures. And even though it's the day when you get really dirty because you're buying groceries and all the cows and the goats are everywhere, everyone would still wear their nicest clothes. And I think something about my village that I just want to share is just the community that I felt there. I really felt like a lot of these people treated me like family. I got to know them. I got to live with them and learn their language. And they were always so happy to hear me say something in the language that they spoke. They spoke Pular. And if I would just greet them like, good morning, how are your kids? They would just be so amazed that this American was there, living there, trying to learn their language. And they were just so welcoming. So I just want to share that about my village.
And Lisa?
Sure. So I served as a public health volunteer. And my village was Dabis. It was in the western coastal region. And it was a village of about 300 individuals. The main source of income for this village was agriculture. I spent a lot of time working in the health center there and working with a nurse and two doctors, which were amazing individuals who planned many sensibilizations or a different word for it, I guess.
Sensitizations? Community education?
Community education kind of thing. And we would go around to different villages in the vicinity and educate people on current health topics. I also worked with people in the Peace Corps on youth development projects. So before I was evacuated, I was working on a grant to do a young women's empowerment conference and also create a young women's jump roping team. So there were a lot of different areas to get involved with. Just because I was in public health didn't mean that, or to any of us, that we had to stick in just that category.
Okay, I'm going to go back to Lisa. Since you were there when the epidemic hit, what was it like for you when you first caught wind of what was going on? What were you told, and how did you feel?
Sure. So when I first heard about what was going on, it was in March, and I received a letter in my village. I was working at the health center at that time, and the letter mentioned a hemorrhagic fever and talked about the signs and the symptoms of the illness. It never did mention Ebola, but it was later confirmed that it was actually Ebola. I called home and talked to my family, asked if they had heard anything, and Peace Corps and my family both validated that it was in fact Ebola. There was a lot of times when I had to kind of sort through different information that was coming at me. When I would call home, my family would talk about what was going on in the media, and there was oftentimes a lot of drama within the media. And then I would get this information from the Peace Corps that was very clear-cut, and this is what's going on at the ground level. So kind of sorting through that was definitely a focus for me. I also was worried at times. It kind of waxed and waned. So at times it could become very real. For example, one of my friends and a physician who worked in the emergency department in Conakry told me a story about his friend and colleague who was one of the first people to assess a patient in Conakry who had come into the clinic with Ebola. And later on, his friend passed because he had contracted Ebola. So that was really a very real moment for me. But at times it seemed very distant also. Within my village, I would try and engage in different conversations with community members, and they would kind of joke and say, it's not here, so you don't have to worry about it, and then invite me over for a dinner of bushmeat. And so it was really hard to kind of take both of those sides and form my own opinions and know what was really going on.
Veronica?
I think my experience was more on the side of what Lisa was saying, the distance. I was in a large village, but it was very remote. It was at least 50 kilometers off the main road. It was just a dirt road to my village, and we were way up in the mountains. So in my village, I felt like nobody was really worried about Ebola, especially in those months of March and April, and even May, I believe. Most people had heard on the radio, or at least the ones who understood French, that, oh, there's Ebola, it's mostly in the forest region, which was more of the southeastern part of the country. And we were so far from that region, and we were so far from the capital of Conakry, that most people just kind of went on with their daily life. They would, you know, go to school, they would do the farming, they would chop wood, do the cooking, wash their clothes at the river, and just kind of went on with the daily life. I know with Peace Corps, they did give us warnings over text and emails about things that we should avoid. Avoid going to the health center. Avoid, touching, like the fluids of someone sick, or avoid being around sick people or deceased. So there were all those warnings, but overall, in my experience, especially in those first couple of months, it felt so far away. It felt like it wasn't even an issue at all. I think in my village, in those months, I was really working on educating my community about malaria and about the fact that we had to sleep under mosquito nets because we did have high rates of malaria, and people were just kind of complacent about it and saying, oh, you know, our region is really cold in the capital. It's hotter and there are mosquitoes there. And over here, we don't have mosquitoes. But I was telling them, well, we don't have mosquitoes. How are there all these rates of malaria here? So I think that was more of my concern at those first couple months.
Okay, I have a question for Hillary. You left before the evacuation, but can you explain what you did there in terms of waste management, and if you have any contact with people, how that has affected your program?
Yeah, sure. So
I was in Guinea. I worked a lot in waste management and recycling. As I had mentioned, there's no waste systems at all in the country. And so one of the projects that I did while I was there is worked with local community leaders to install a pilot system with, like, we set up 100 trash cans, rooted them in the ground throughout the town, and had a team of youth that drove around these little motorcycle wagons to, like, empty the trash barrels. We built a tiny recycling center where we were composting the biodegradable waste and recycling the plastic to resell back to a company that we had identified in the capital city that purchased plastic. And then actually it was like the most amazing factory. They had these like massive machines that would boil the plastic into a liquid form and then injection mold it again to produce like buckets and washboards. And it was marvelous and actually has created quite a few jobs for youth in the capital city who just literally make their income from collecting dirty plastic from the trash. So anyhow, this was a system that we had worked on in my city, and in contact with them since then. It's just not continued to function very well with the epidemic and just like the erosion of morale. And so it's unfortunate in the sense that it's a deep need because the sanitation issues are incredibly extreme there. And I would say that it's a public health concern as well in terms of propagating disease and mosquitoes and, you know, it gets into the water tables. So that was a lot of my work, and so it's been a journey for me to hear what's happened since then. Also, I worked a lot in entrepreneurship, and some of our entrepreneurs who won the competition for the program that we rolled out, I guess you could call it, we've also caught wind. So one of the winning entrepreneurs' ideas was to create a public composting toilet, and he, of course, hasn't been able to really build that because it was supposed to be stationed in the country's transit spot where everyone eats. It's actually awfully, awfully dirty. Linsan, do you guys remember Linsan? Yeah, it was just brutal. Like eating your bowl of rice next to like feces in the street. So this boy was going to build a public toilet that would be, it was called Toilette d'Or, which means toilet of gold. And people could pass through and pay a mille franc, which is equivalent of like 5 cents. So 1,000 franc Guinean is like 5 to 10 cents. It's very minimal price, nominal price. But that fee would then upkeep the cleaning of this toilet that also would compost the waste beneath the ground. And he would then very much later sell that waste to farmers. It would be compost at that point. But his entire execution, once we gave him, he won funding to do this, and his entire execution has been derailed due to the epidemic. And so there's definite challenges with some of the project work that I was involved in.
Okay. Let me start again with Lisa. I've asked you this before in a different way, but were you afraid, and what was evacuation like?
First, was I afraid? At times, it seemed worrisome. I, like Veronica, during the time when Ebola erupted, I was working on a malaria project, and we were going door to door, and some people were sick in their homes, and I kind of got a little worrisome about that. Like, what did they have? Could I contract this? So, it was sort of worrisome at times, but generally, I felt very protected. There were precautions that were put in place. Peace Corps was very adamant, wash your hands, don't be around people who might have the illness. So we did take precautions. The second question, what was the evacuation like? The evacuation was very sudden and very unexpected. By the time July rolled around, I really didn't have any reason to believe that we would be evacuated. We all knew very well that it was present, but given the precautions that we were taking, it just didn't seem like it would happen. So that fateful day that we received the text message that we were leaving, there were a lot of mixed emotions. What was really going on? Was this really going to be temporary? So I went to my host family and my friends and talked about this evacuation and tried to reassure them that it was temporary, but also try and reassure myself. But they knew better. the previous two volunteers that were in my village were both evacuated, and they said that it was temporary, but they never were able to return. So this was really hard to deal with, especially when I had to call back in October and tell them that actually I wasn't going to be coming back anytime soon. The evacuation was quick, so it was a matter of days that we were up and out of the country. And I really thought that the media uproar of the United States would really manifest itself as soon as we re-entered the country. I had these ideas that maybe we would be isolated or people would be really opposed to us coming home. Or just what were they going to think? How was this going to go? And really, there weren't. There was no backlash. We got into the country and we were let in and the community was welcoming. And so I really appreciated this understanding and knowledge. But I also have to attribute it somewhat to an ignorance, too. I know some people didn't exactly know what was going on, weren't following it until there was a case in the United States. And I still find that to be true sometimes. People, I'll be talking with someone in a conversation and talk about a little bit about Guinea. And there was one woman I remember when I got back to Ohio who kept calling it Ebola. And every time that I would try and say Ebola to correct her, she's like, oh, that Ebola, that's so awful. And so it's just, we need to, it's great that we can be here today and present the knowledge and really give a face to Guinea and what's going on there.
Veronica?
So, like Lisa said, the evacuation was really fast and really sudden. I think in those last couple of days, just saying bye to people in my village, explaining, oh, why I was leaving, and them kind of thinking it was ridiculous, like, because they were still, you know, like I said earlier, they were still going on with their everyday lives because they didn't have that choice. Like, we as Peace Corps volunteers, as Americans, they, you know, it's upon Peace Corps to keep us safe, and so they decided it wasn't safe and that we had to leave. But, you know, those people in my village and who I considered family and friends, they didn't have a choice. I mean, like, they're just going to live there, you know. They can't escape or whatnot. Like, we could just hop on a plane and just go, and I just felt that privilege. And I think one of the hardest things was when I was saying bye to everyone, and, like, especially my closest friends in Pular, in the local language, when you're saying if and when, it's the same word. So when I was telling people, if or when it gets better, I'll be back. So it could have been understood as when it gets better, I'll be back, or if it gets better, I'll be back. So it was just kind of this idea of not knowing whether I was going to be there, and me telling them, oh, if it gets better, I'll be back. But I was also bringing, like, a huge suitcase, and all of them being like, well, how long? And what, you know, how will we contact you? So that was really, really difficult. And then I think coming back to America, something that was difficult was, I mean, the stigma in going to a medical office and, you know, having a routine appointment and them saying, oh, you were in Guinea, and just kind of them kind of being taken aback by that. It was like nothing compared to, I guess, you know, the stigma that they're constantly receiving of people not wanting to work with them, or, you know, for them being able to ship their goods. So that was another challenge. And then also being back, a lot of my friends were kind of like, oh, we're so happy to see you, because I had been there for exactly 1 year, and I had 1 year left. So I had just, you know, felt really good in my village. I felt good with the language. I felt ready to start an awesome second year and, you know, do a lot of projects in my community. But then I had to come back, and all my friends were like, aren't you happy? Like, you can have a burger and you can have pizza. And I just, no, they just, like, really didn't understand that I wasn't happy. I didn't want to be in America. I hadn't mentally prepared myself to be in America for another year. I had just felt ready to, like, really be on the ground and do some work in my village. So that was a challenge.
Okay, I have the same question for all three of you. In terms of repatriation and coming back, what adjustments did you have to make? I'm going to start with Veronica because you were talking about that, and then we'll go to Lisa and Hillary.
Adjustments to my lifestyle in America?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you also the attitude and the people you meet and your family and so on.
And also, too, sorry, Frank, I just know that you guys were placed on hold for a long time, so I'd love for you to share about that.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess I think my coming back to America, I think if you all are PCBs out there, you might have felt that shock of being in America and just feeling the excesses. I remember being back in America and I in my village, I didn't have running water, I didn't have electricity, I didn't have paved roads. And so coming back to America, I came into my parents' house and I just remember seeing, like, they had two blenders, and I was just like, and they had two microwaves, and I was just so upset. I was like, what do you need that for? And I was just so, like, angry, and, like, I just didn't feel comfortable being there, feel like it was my home. And I remember my parents telling me about the drought in California and how we have to conserve water. But when I would turn on the faucet, the water would come out. And I was just wondering, like, so we're really in a drought? Because in my village, I would walk, you know, a couple kilometers, get to my water pump, you get the key out, figure out who has the key first, then you finally unlock it, you turn the spigot, no water. Okay, I guess I'm walking a little bit farther, and now I'm going to pump the water with my foot. So over there, it was like, it was more obvious and clear. Whereas over here, I saw people watering their lawns, and I was like, is there really a drought? Because people are not acting like it, and people were doing that silly ice bucket challenge, and I was just so upset, I guess. And I just, I felt like all these contradictions, and I just also felt really guilty because I was an American. I just felt like, you know, people in my village were wondering what I was doing and if I remembered them, and I did, but it was so hard to contact them.
Lisa?
Sure. So I think what most sticks out in my mind, again, any of our PCBs out there, there's such a reverse culture shock when you get back. And so a really prominent story for me was I walked into Whole Foods when I got back, and I had dreamed of Whole Foods the whole time I was over there. And when I got back, I didn't think it would hit me as hard as it did. And I walked in and was just looking at all the food. And even now, I get, like, chills thinking about it because it was just, I couldn't do it. I started crying. I had to, like, leave the store because the people that I had spent these past 8 months with, they never see something like that. And so that was just really a shocker for me. Also, coming back, there's like different things that you really notice about America that you hadn't before. And in my village, it was really important, and I think within all of Guinea, it was really a cultural custom that you would greet everyone that you walked past. If you didn't greet them, then you were rude, and they would call you out on it. So in America, it's not like that, and especially in the bigger cities. I recently moved to San Francisco, and people don't even look at you as you're passing them on the street. So just getting used to those different cultures and trying to reintegrate, really. Being put on hold was really hard. It was really hard. We didn't know if we were going to go back and when it might be and what it might look like. I couldn't quite figure out how anything was going to go, and we knew the situation wasn't looking good, but I'm still curious to see when they might reopen. We receive emails, and they haven't really said much in the way of going back and when that might be yet, so we're still very hopeful that they can reopen the program.
Oh, and just to add to that, yeah, they put us on hold from late July when we arrived, so like July 29th to about October 31st was when we closed out. So it's kind of a couple of months of just being in limbo.
Putting aside future considerations and future plans, would you go back if the opportunity presented itself? I'll start with Hillary first and then go.
And as a Peace Corps volunteer?
In any capacity.
I definitely think I'm still very involved with some of the project work that I did while I was there. And myself and six other volunteers founded an organization that teaches youth social entrepreneurship. So I think I will definitely be back to Guinea at some point.
So I think I see myself back at least to visit. I think those couple of months that they had us waiting were really challenging for me. And so I don't know if I would be able to put myself in the place of being there again for 2 years to serve, but I would definitely be back to visit family.
I agree. I really hope to return someday, and if the right opportunity presented itself, I would certainly consider it in the future.
Well, first of all, we're not finished, but I would like to thank the three of them, Veronica, Hillary, and Lisa, for sharing their experiences as Peace Corps volunteers in Guinea. I always say Guinea. I guess it's my time in Cote d'Ivoire. In Guinea, West Africa, before Peace Corps evacuated that country due to the Ebola outbreak. We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program at the Commonwealth Club of America, Ebola and the evacuation of Peace Corps in Guinea. Now, are there any audience questions? I think I'll... Yes, please.
Okay. I have a question. You haven't gone back yet, but did the experience that you have change your vocational aspirations or channel you into a different direction than what you thought when you went over? All of you.
You guys want to go? That's a phenomenal question. I think when you come back, another adjustment culturally is America is such like a work heavy society where often your identity is formed around what you do rather than who you are. And I think that for me at least was one of the hardest adjustments coming back was to like adjust to the pace of life and also that construct and how to wrap one identity and what all of that means and process it into what my identity is now. And actually, I have quite a few colleagues in the audience, which is really wonderful and helps to make that feel like it's bridged more so. So thank you all. But I am doing something very different than what I ever thought I would be doing, which is recruiting.
Wow. Well, I went into the Peace Corps thinking about becoming a science teacher, a middle school science teacher, and I am still on that path. I taught in Guinea, and next week I'm actually going to start my master's classes at USF for a master's in teaching and a credential in science.
Yes, I knew that I loved health. I do have my nursing license, and after I came back, I was completely certain that I really love public health, and I'd like to go in something international and public health related.
Hi. I too am a returned Peace Corps volunteer and have really loved your stories. And I've been a returned Peace Corps volunteer for about 20 years. And I'm curious from you guys, who was the most influential new friend, new family member that you met during your time in Guinea? And do you still keep up with them today? And what are you hearing from them about the Ebola crisis? How do you like that? Three questions in one.
You want to take that?
Okay, I'll start. So I had a really awesome best friend in my village. His name was Umar. And I met him through my principal during my site visit. My principal told me that he was one of the few folks in our village who was university educated, but unfortunately, after he graduated from the university, he couldn't find, a real job. So he was working mostly in the village, just selling small items. And so he was an amazing friend. I would spend every day after school just telling him stories about my students. We would practice French and Pular together. He was so patient, especially with my language skills in the beginning, to teach me and to just practice with me. And he also had a little shop, so anytime someone would come in, I would like greet them in Pular, and he would correct me or help me out. So he was amazing, and I would really consider him like my brother. And sometimes when someone would come in from our village from some other village and they didn't know me or us, we would kind of mess with them and tell them that we were really related, and I would speak in Pular, and we would talk about how, you know, I grew up in America and he grew up in Guinea, and how we actually really are related. And so it was just really fun. Our relationship was always so amazing, and I just loved our conversations. We would talk about political things and deep things, and just funny things. So
my friendship really came from this deep annoyance with person. arrived in my village and was immediately asked to teach English at the middle school. And the principal brought me into the middle school and told me to introduce myself. And mind you, my French wasn't very good at that point. So the English teacher at the time said he would translate everything that I was saying from English into French. And I found that my short speech turned into something that was much, much longer, so I have no idea what he added to that. But then I came to find that he was actually a really great person. We spent a lot of time together and had a lot of the same interests, and I do still keep in touch with him. I just heard from him the other day. He somehow got on Gmail and messaged me, and which was really exciting. So it's amazing how technology can connect people, and I'm so thankful that it did.
I totally fell in love with my host mom, who lives right next door, or lived right next door to me in Guinea. I arrived on my first site visit, so before I actually moved there, and was not very good at French. I didn't speak at all before I arrived in Guinea, and was truly rendered speechless in a lot of ways during that visit, and she and I were able to connect on a wavelength that didn't necessitate words, which was great. I woke up my first morning and was freezing because I also lived, like Veronica, in the mountains, and quite often it would actually hail during the rainy season, and there were pine trees, and I didn't know this before I went to my site, and so I was so cold when I woke up, and she just immediately, like intuition, knew what I needed. She gave me extra blankets. She gave me a big tub of like peanut butter, which was so awesome, like invited me in for tea, and we had like broken conversation, and she honestly she still is to this day. I consider her my second mother, and we do talk a lot. Thankfully, there's this new app called Viber, and all it takes is her to be on the internet and me to be on the internet, and we can literally talk for free, and the connection's amazing. So we had like an hour and a half conversation like 2 days ago, and like immediately she asks like, how are you doing? And I just like word vomit, like, Nene, like, I have no idea what I'm doing with my life. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, how are you? Like, what's the situation in Guinea? And she was just like, I know, like, God will put you on the right path. Like, it's, you know, like, destiny will, I think she's like a walking prophet, like this Ghanaian woman. So she and I totally connect, and she always asks about my nieces. I have two new nieces. So she's absolutely one of my best friends and my second mother.
Hello, my name's Drew. I'm an RPCV from Niger, 03 to 06, so definitely know about the amoebic dysentery.
Yeah. Yes.
Solidarity. Bringing levity into this conversation, I know you mentioned the Napoleon Dynamite t-shirt, all the irony, the taxi full of mangoes. I just wanted to hear some, you know, quick stories, like one of the most ironic, funny moments you experienced while you were serving.
Really quickly, so my favorite rice shack, this is like basically very illegitimate, very unsanitary wooden structures on the sides of the road where you can buy like a plate of rice. You would never know it's a restaurant, but it is. My favorite rice shack was actually at the taxi gar. It's like where you go to get the taxi and often find yourself waiting for 5 hours because the taxi won't leave until it's full, which means that you need to have four people in back and two people sitting in the front seat. So like you literally would be sitting there potentially for 5 hours until that last seat was bought and then you leave. So like I would always go to this rice shack, and I started to develop a patterned understanding of this woman who ran the rice shack. And she was like 11 months pregnant. Like she was about to burst yesterday. Like she was so pregnant. And every single day, she had this like toothless grin that was so genuine and so full of joy. And she would serve me my plate of rice with like the peanut sauce or the leaf sauce, like grinning so big, like I can't even explain. And her t-shirt, the same t-shirt she wore daily, was navy, and it would like stretch over her like giant belly. And it just said in big white bold letters, "Shut up and do me." And like, had no idea. And that's honestly only one small example. Like, I've seen a guy where, like, drink till you want me. I saw, like, my boyfriend's in the army. Like, I could go on. I've made lists of the t-shirts that I saw.
A really funny story from my experience. The same friend that I mentioned before had lent me his bike because the brake, or my tire had popped on my bike. And he told me before I took the bike that there were no brakes on it. And so as soon as I got on, I went to go ride and thought it would be fine, but immediately found myself coasting down this hill in the middle of the village, and I couldn't stop, and I didn't know how, and it was just, the hill was getting larger, and the whole village was looking on in fear, like, oh my gosh, what should we do? And then a friend of mine happened to be holding a pair of scissors and was running after me, trying to, like, stop the bike. It was a mess. And I have many stories like that where people just looked on, like, what is that crazy white girl doing? Oh, my gosh. So, yeah, lots of really great.
I just have a short one from when I was in the capital city, and the markets were a lot bigger than in the villages, so you could find a little bit more than what you're used to. And I remember I was shopping with another Peace Corps volunteer, and we found basil, and we hadn't had basil in at least 8 months. And I remember as soon as she smelled it, she kind of like freaked out, and we just started screaming in the marketplace. And the marketplace is this like dank, scary alleyway, and all the market ladies who sell their vegetables were kind of staring at us like those crazy Americans, because we were just so excited that we had found basil. So that was just one little one.
Oh, here's another RPCB who was in Cote d'Ivoire, right next door to Liberia and Sierra Leone. And I've been back several times and have many, many good friends there. And they tried to close the border between Liberia and Sierra Leone and Cote d'Ivoire. Can you close a border? I don't know. They may did their best effort. But my concern, I understand Ebola is now gone from Liberia, but in Guinea, it still exists. So are you keeping track of that? And what kind of preventive measures are taken, and what's the hope for the future of Ebola in Guinea?
Yeah, so actually I just read in the news yesterday or today that there was another case that was found in Liberia, in an area that was not, it's not close to the border. So that's currently a concern of how to trace that and where it comes from. But from my contact who's been advising the response in Guinea, I think there still needs a lot to be done, and Ebola will not be over until there are no cases, and until there are no cases and 3 to 4 weeks have passed. And so I think the challenge when you get closer to zero is that you start to get lackadaisical. And so it really requires like a strong presence and an adherence to discipline. And these are places where there's not been a history of that. And so, it's going to take a lot of commitment on behalf of people who are really just rooted there, but also an approach that incorporates an anthropological understanding. So I also have some friends, some of our Peace Corps colleagues who were there with us have been hired by the CDC to go back to those areas and kind of be the cultural liaisons for some of the people who are doing some of the trainings and trying to make that situation understandable.
Before you go, we only have one time for one more question, unfortunately. So you have a question back there?
I've got the microphone power there. I think as Veronica spoke about working with malaria, but a recent news report mentioned that that had been rather neglected, they felt, because of the Ebola epidemic, that malaria treatment had been put in the shade. Is that correct, do you think?
Yeah, I do think that is correct. I know Ebola is very much the focus right now, and it's disappointing. I know that Guinea is in such need of development, and it's sad that Ebola is taking place right now. It's sad for a lot of reasons. There's one, health reasons. Malaria, big diseases such as that are being neglected, and oftentimes I'll call my neighbors from my house and from my village in Dobbies, and they'll tell me that the children aren't going to school anymore or at different times because the schools are closed due to fear of Ebola. Different organizations and projects have kind of come to a standstill because of this fear. And so there are, in a lot of ways, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard to come back from that.
And just a quick add to that, malaria's early symptoms are almost identical to the onset of Ebola. And so in addition to the health centers primarily, especially early on, being consumed mostly by Ebola patients, there's a stigma, I think, associated with bringing your child to a health clinic because there's been this ingrained understanding that it's possible that it could be Ebola, and if that is the case, you might never see your family member ever again. And so there's a resistance on behalf of people who are infected with malaria to even seek help in the first place, and it's definitely, I think, increased in terms of the fatalities. Whereas I think if it weren't for Ebola, people would go to get the medication because it's a preventable disease.
You know, as we close, I'd like to raise a toast to Jack Kennedy. President John Kennedy had the idea of the Peace Corps, and I think we should celebrate that tonight. Thank you.
Our thanks to Lisa Hoffman, Hilary Brasseth, and Veronica Canilau, and our moderator, Frank Price. We also thank our audience here and our listening audience. This event is a collaboration with the Northern California Peace Corps Association, a nonprofit dedicated to promoting understanding between peoples of the world. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 112th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.